Hello and welcome to the Creighton Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast. I'm Graham Smith and I'm joined today by
Chris Thurston,
Tom Francis,
and
Philippa Ward.
All four of us, and we got it right. No one said hello like I did last episode.
But you know what we didn't say?
The episode number or the date.
Indeed.
Which is episode 79 and February 10th.
Hooray!
Well spotted, Chris.
That's okay.
It seemed brief, the time between saying hello and introducing you guys, but there we go.
Without making a mistake at the beginning, we actually did make a mistake at the beginning.
Let's just roll straight on into news.
Okay.
Goddess seems like the news of the week. Or really kind of like the news of the last 6 months. But people only just sort of noticed 2 days ago.
Yeah.
So, Peter Molyneux crowdfunded Goddess, which was his return to the God game, in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And made a bunch of promises, which he hasn't followed through on, which is kind of typical of Peter Molyneux, but is sort of tricky when those were the grounds on which he was given £500,000 in order to make that game. And it was notable this past week, or, well, last month, when the now sort of lead designer on the game started posting quite openly, publicly, to say that they probably weren't going to hit a lot of those Kickstarter goals, that he had very limited resources in order to make the game good and had been basically told to focus on things that he could get done with limited resources and get done quickly. And then since then, Peter Molyneux has come out and said, yeah, we probably should have done all those Kickstarter promises that we did, but we're not going to.
Thanks for that input. We probably should have done the things you say we should have done.
He's all full of regrets and lessons learned.
Spends a lot of his life regretting
things, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, he said those words.
I just wonder if eventually it will appear that a lesson learned is actually measured by what you subsequently do, by whether or not you say the words lesson learned in time. It's not like playing Snap, for example, where the goal is to say Snap correctly.
But you have to actually have put the cards down.
You do.
Sorry,
maybe the
that
analogy doesn't hold.
Technicality.
I'm going to use your strategy next time. I'm going to win so hard.
Can't you? You can say Snap even if it's not you putting the card down, though, right?
Yes.
So technically there are scenarios where all you have to do is say
Snap. There are also like house rules where you put your hand down over the thing so there's no like arguing over who said it first because your hand is physically under the other person's hand.
That's a more physical version of Snap that I don't personally go in for. It's kind
of like Snap! Punch. A more robust and feature-complete game than Goddess. Graham, continue. You're saying.
Well, he basically... He said... in December, early December, at an indie games event in Spain or something, he gave a bunch of interviews and talked about how he wouldn't do a Kickstarter in the same way again. And he had problems with it because it incentivized you to just say anything in order to get the money. And I think he phrased it as, oh shit, there's only 10 days left, just say anything.
Yeah, something like that. They were, what, 100,000 short or something, something at that point? Like that.
But in the end, they evidently shot past their goal because they had stretch goals, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the ways that they got the money, I guess, is by saying, hey, hit these stretch goals and we'll give you Linux support, for example. Even though they knew that the middleware that they were using on which to build the game doesn't support Linux and still doesn't. And they don't have any control over whether it does or not. So it's just a thing that in order to make it work on Linux, they would need to recode the game or presumably pay the middleware creator a whole bunch of money in order to do it. But similarly, they promised multiplayer, and that's not in. It was supposed to have like a weird persistent hub world that linked all the in-game stuff, and that didn't happen.
The
Curiosity
designer guy now says that it's looking shaky. Is his phrasing, I think.
Which is great. Mm. Also, I mean, like 22 Cans, the company that's making this game, their last game, Curiosity, the winner of which was supposed to be the God and Goddess. He's not the God and Goddess because it doesn't have any of the multiplayer functionality it needs in order for that to make sense. So it's just a 19-year-old guy out there in Scotland somewhere thinking.
Should never have tapped the centre of that magical cube. The promises you make at the centre of a magical cube aren't binding by any known court of law. It's like Kickstarter.
Is he getting his percentage, though? Because he was promised like a percentage of there.
I don't know. No one's interviewed him since.
That was the life-changing thing.
Yeah, he was supposed to get
load of money.
A tiny percentage of a free-to-play game.
Apparently, it's still, like, Molyneux suggested that it was making money on mobile, which is why it was difficult, he said, for them to support the PC version.
Because all this money, just hitting him in the side of the face and trying to work, it's just flying out of the walls.
It's like, they want to make it not shit for the mobile users, because those are the ones that are giving them money. But the people who actually funded it through Kickstarter were people who wanted to play it on PC, because that's where his audience was. So...
But it's okay, because now he's working on a new thing.
Yeah!
And he seems really excited about that, so it seems like that's going to be brilliant and have no problems.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is they've shifted. So, like, a whole bunch of people left the studio, either because they quit or were asked to leave, and they're hiring new people, but they're hiring them all to work on The Trail, which is the new mobile game.
Is it
working
The
on
Trail?
Maybe. I heard maybe it was The Trail.
Maybe yeah. Okay, well, I've just been misreading that word for the last 2 days. But that's the crazy thing, like, the designer...
But they won't talk about it, so you're not to really.
Well, that would be the perfect Peter Molyneux game. It's just one that he consistently hypes, but never actually gives any concrete details of and never releases. So you could just talk about that for...
It could actually
years.
Be an adaptation of The Trial. Where you're just stuck in a series of endless, like, beta access request forms and Kickstarter pledges that go nowhere forever.
He could do it on Patreon. Like, rather than... The problem is the business model doesn't suit his talents, because the business model involves releasing a thing and then people pay you for the thing, or paying you money up front on the basis that you will do the thing. Whereas what he really needs is Patreon, where you just back somebody for just keep on doing what you're doing. Just do your thing. We like your thing. Keep doing the thing. And his thing is just talking endlessly about the amazing things he's going to do.
He should just make YouTube videos. He should just, you know, stream his ideas. But the guy who's now the kind of lead designer of Goddess is a guy who, like, 6 months or a year ago just started emailing the team to say that he was really worried about the direction of the game and he thought it was terrible and it was doing all the wrong things and they're constantly making suggestions about how they can make it better. And
he was
eventually
basically a concerned backer, wasn't he?
Yeah, pretty much. And eventually they gave him a role working on the project, an unpaid role.
Jesus Christ.
Because they weren't hiring anyone at that time, but, you know, come on in and help us out, since you seem so keen, and do it for free.
Presumably he did back them on Kickstarter, so after giving them money, and also had to give them labour to get the game working.
So. And then, like, 6 months after that, they've now put him on salary, and so he's now the lead designer of Goddess.
Only remaining person who cares.
Yeah.
We found one. This guy gives a shit.
But there was an amazing moment in the interview that they were doing with Peter Molyneux when he was doing the sort of the Q&A from concerned backers, you know, that went out. Was it today or yesterday?
It was either late last night or this morning. Yeah,
and at one point he says something like, you know, and he's trying to imply that they're just over the other side of the studio and they're really sort of, you know, they're just within reach, you know, and he kind of says, yeah, we're keeping them at arm's length from us, or something like that. And you're like, I don't think arm's length quite works in this scenario. And then he goes on to say that he touches them regularly and you're kind of like, okay, this has just tipped over into the office. I mean, if it hadn't before, which it really had. But, yeah, so that's...
That lead designer guy was on the video and Molyneux says at one point that the lead designer guy really loves the game and the lead designer rolls his eyes.
This man questioned my design. Now he's trapped in my magical cube.
He spends a lot of it with his e-cig, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The lead designer guy.
That was uncomfortable as well.
I started watching it and I couldn't get past like just a few lines. It was just so awkward. I found that with their videos before. I've started to watch, I think, like 3 or 4 of their videos over the years. And there's always someone else introducing it. And Peter's just sort of sitting there. And like the guy is really sort of deferential to Peter, but also kind of has to host it and ask him the tough questions, and that's just
what's
the tension
name?
Is just
is it like Jack or something.
Can't watch it
with the slightly oddly shaped microphone.
I don't know.
It is. That's not. It's a slightly odd thing. It looks kind of like a Zoom lolly or something. I don't know.
There's no part of the videos which aren't just horribly awkward to look at or sit through.
Mm. They could have kickstarted a nightmarish games industry cringe comedy. And they would have delivered.
Yeah, if this is all a big mockumentary, it's fantastic.
There's a whole bunch of other stuff where I haven't even mentioned that they haven't delivered. They said they would do a making of books, no sign of that. They said they would launch forums so that game students could learn about game development and ask questions of the team. They haven't launched those forums. And in fact, the forums that they did have, they've closed down.
What about that? Like, they've got that art book that they said they'd do as well, and wasn't it that on the video Peter Molyneux was like, "Well, we've still got the artwork, so we can like revisit that or something."
Yeah, they've just been really busy though, so they haven't got around to it yet.
Wasn't part of the like concept for the studio is that like half of them were totally new to the games industry or something? Like only a certain number are allowed to be veterans, and then the rest were like students and fresh faced youngsters, and you're going to teach them the ways of how the games industry works. Mentor them and to become amazing game designers.
I hope that's what they've done.
I think they probably learned a valuable lesson, which I keep hearing from friends about working with very, very well-known designers, which you just never really hear anything good about it. Apart from, I think Sid Meier is the only one where people I talk to who work for him all have good things to say. Every other super famous game designer who I know people have worked for doesn't have great things to say.
I think it's what's the name of the guy who was lead designer on XCOM Enemy Unknown? Jake
Solomon.
Solomon. Yeah. He loves Sid Meier. Yeah. And he's like, most of my interviews with Jake Solomon are just him talking about Sid Meier and me asking him to talk about Sid Meier.
I guess in fairness, all the people who told me about this kind of thing have left the company. So I'm only talking to the ones who, like, the only people who are going to tell me that are the people who don't work there currently. So it's going to be the people who decided to leave. Therefore, it's a selection bias.
Do you think there's, like, hope left for Goddess, then?
No. Well, they did, like, a huge...
Is Goddess dead?
Yes.
Nietzsche's.
They did, like, a big update, like, a year ago, which was meant to be the sort of reboot that was going to fix it. And all it did was make it slightly less annoying. It didn't make it any more fun to actually play.
It was, you used to have to click on all the houses to get the belief, but now you can hold down the mouse and wipe it over. And I did see the part of that video where Peter Molyneux is doing that. It's just beautiful. It just feels beautiful. It's just beautiful interaction. Just magic.
It's not magic, it's clicking.
Click and drag.
But there's still no actual game there. It's still shit. And now it has no team actually working on it. It's just got a guy.
Their company... What's the word? Corporate mission statement?
Mm.
I can't remember the exact figure, it's something like 100 million daily active users. That's it. That's their bold dream for the future of games. Yeah, we just like to have a really large number of people playing our games.
Well, there's still hope for the games industry still, because Atari are back.
Oh, good.
And they're bringing back one of the most beloved games from their back catalogue, Asteroids, with a new game called Asteroids Outpost, which is an open-world survival game set on an asteroid, where you have to gather up items and craft them into defences and shoot other asteroids that are crashing into your asteroid. You know, reminiscent of the old game, Asteroids.
When you shoot those asteroids, do they split into two identical pieces?
They haven't said.
Okay. That's really the only thing that's important.
Well, no. In the press release, did they use rock and roll, or did they use get your rocks off?
Oh, they used... Oh, they did use a rock-based pun. I can't remember what it was now.
This is useless, Graham. Where are the facts?
I like the idea that basically survival games are like disco was in the 70s, where like all the genres of music that are becoming less popular come back and say, oh, we've re-recorded all our biggest hits, but as a disco track. It's like that, except with the need to eat and craft things.
So your Pong bat will starve to death.
Yep.
If you don't like bat enough balls back into the wilderness or whatever.
So are you building more asteroids?
That would be counterintuitive.
I think you're building asteroid defences. In some ways, it doesn't sound very much like Asteroids at all.
I can't imagine that Asteroids is a big enough brand that anyone sort of... Well, it's obviously famous, but there's a difference between having like a famous game design and something that people go, man, I really invested a lot in the particular atmosphere of Asteroids.
Yeah, I really want to go back to that place.
Yeah,
soak up more of the lore.
Particularly when Asteroids, like, you know, if you are learning game creation software for the first time, you probably either make Mario, Galaga, or Asteroids, broadly speaking, right? Yeah. Like, it's going to be somewhere in that trilogy. Like, actually, Galaga I would probably, like, associate more with, because it's a more interesting word than Asteroids. just at the very, very basic level, it's fun to say. Galaga. You know?
Has there been any example of, like, one of those very early classic arcade games or very early home computer games being revived and modernized and actually being any good?
When you say modernized, do you mean not just like remastered, but actually like fundamentally? Because like Pac-Man is.
Yeah, I was thinking Pac-Man.
Pac-Man is still rad. Like, yeah, Pac-Man like CDX is genuinely great and like adds new ideas to that game, but it's still Pac-Man. You're still it's not like it reimagines Pac-Man as a survival game. Although, actually, Pac-Man would make more sense as a survival game than Asteroids did.
There was a sort of an 8 Pages meets Pac-Man game that I found on one of those free sites a little while ago. It was brilliant.
Oh, like Slenderman kind
of
thing.
Yeah, yeah. It was, yeah, like, so Pac-Man would just sort of sneak up behind you and you'd see him with your torch with... No, you were sort of... I think you were Pac-Man and a ghost would sneak up behind you. And I think it was Clyde.
See, but perfect. Yeah,
so you'd see him, like, over you, like, towering over you. You'd be terrified.
What is in Atari's back catalogue that they could have done instead of this?
This feels like a question that we should know the answer to. But just, I mean,
E.T.?
there are lots of those games. Like, is Galaga one of them?
I don't know.
I don't know. Like
Sinistar? What happened to Sinistar?
I found the rock pun, which is... reinvents the classic Atari title as an open-world sandbox-style survival experience where players mine, build, and defend their base and grow their fortune as they go from rocks to riches.
Oof. That doesn't make any sense.
That's not even a...
From
rags to riches, from rocks to...
I guess so, maybe like a Minecraft element to it? That would make sense.
Yeah.
Kids love hitting rocks these days. We've had a game about hitting rocks for the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah. Can't we get some of them bucks? Yeah.
Hitting rocks, bucks. we go from rocks.
Quick, mention
to
rocks in the press release.
Maybe we're being too cynical about this. Maybe this stems from a genuine creative urge to reinvent the popular Asteroids franchise.
It reminds me of the Battleship movie. You know, yeah. It's just like all we've got is just a word, and it's just like, we've got nothing else.
It's an evocative word.
They could go with the original premise of Asteroids and maybe just like remake the game, but then they could go rock and ruin. Because that's the actual point. That works better as... let me do your press releases for games that don't exist. Come on!
It does exist, though. That's the worrying thing about this.
The remastered version doesn't, no. I don't think. Maybe.
They do note in the press release that Atari's portfolio contains more than 200 games and franchises.
None of which were made.
No. It is like you say, they're not really franchises that people invest in. And then, like, although the Pac-Man... Championship Edition DX or whatever was great. Like, Namco's attempts to make people care about Pac-Man as an entity divorced from the specific product that they're selling is always kind of sad.
Yeah.
Like, they did a whole bunch of stuff based around Pac is Back, I think was the campaign. Like, hiring dancers to dance to, like, a 1980s...
A hologram pops. Pac-Man appearing on stage with Kanye West.
It wasn't even that. It was just, like, a London-based dance troupe that they'd hired to dance in a shopping centre in London to a 1980s pop single released to coincide with some Pac-branded breakfast cereal that was on sale 30 years ago. So if you imagine people today dancing to that, that's kind of like... You guys remember Pac? Well, Pac is back! And he's still cool! Remember, Ken?
Please? The thing that gets me is, like, I mean, there's probably, like, a theory of the industry thing in this, where it's, like, as soon as people started creating mascots for their games, so Pac-Man is sort of, like, proto-Mario, Sonic, whatever, you start to remember specific companies, you start to remember specific series, but before that, a lot of game designs are not, like, common property now, because probably someone does own Asteroids, Atari do, or someone does own Breakout, or someone does own Pong, or whatever. But those games come from a time where the limitations of the hardware meant that there are not only so many games you could really make. Thing bounces off other thing. Thing goes into thing, splitting it into two things. You know what I mean?
The other thing is copyright protection, because those, you know, like, you can't copyright game mechanics. You can copyright code, and you can copyright imagery and things, and sound. But, like, you can make an Asteroid game, and given that people didn't really invest in the visuals of Asteroid. Like, that's obviously going to be a problem.
It's not like Asteroids is like the thrilling tale of John Asteroid that everyone remembers and loves. Like,
maybe it will
maybe
be now.
Now.
Yeah. Oh, God. But like, but that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, Asteroids is like the first game you make or whatever. Like, because it feels like it's sort of a common design ideas that you learn how to do on your way to doing something else. It's not like anyone remembers it and would go, I don't even know what that looks like, you know? Like, whereas if someone told me, oh, they're making a 3D Pac-Man platformer, I have some idea, at least the iconography of that, or the visuals of that, or some idea about some of its gameplay ideas. With an Asteroids game, I know literally nothing. They may as well have announced a survival game set in space.
There was a TV show on, like, CITV, I think, about 20 years ago called Astro Farm, and I'm kind of hoping it's like that, where you just have a farm on an asteroid and it's lovely.
That would be nice.
Seems reasonable but unlikely.
Unfortunately, yeah, there's two screenshots.
I don't know
so
if
it looks
they're going
more
after
like
the kid bucks.
Gears,
in terms of kind of grimy sci-fi aesthetic.
Rockstar radishes. That's just completely divorced from the original phrase.
Is that what you've come up with?
It's just two words that aren't even in the original saying.
Lead your rocks to market.
You can take a rock to water, but you can't
make it rock.
But that's not Asteroids. So stop.
That's off brand now.
What have you been playing, Tom?
I have been playing Invisible Ink again, and in some sense, still. Since, like, before Christmas, I guess. And it's still not done, and it's still a roguelike in which there's no like sort of long-term progression. I'm just replaying it essentially, but it's a weird change from like Spelunky, where you play and a normal life in Spelunky will last like 5 minutes and a great one will last like 30 minutes, and then you die and you restart and everything's different again. And Invisible Ink, a typical campaign would be like 8 hours if you get through it, and in fact, unlike Spelunky, I've got to the point where, like, I'm not great at it, but playing on the mode I'm playing on, a campaign will typically last 8 hours. I will usually get to the end of it. Things might go wrong and not go the way I want them to, but it's a much more kind of... It's a very harsh game still, and very difficult to get your head around at first, but once you know how it works, it's much more forgiving than Spelunky, because so many things can go wrong and you can still recover. And I had that recently where you have two agents normally. It's turn-based XCOM stealth, basically. But you, when one goes down, first of all, when an enemy sees one, time, it's already turn-based, but time, like, stops then and there, even though it's in the middle of the enemy turn. And you get to do something about it. So if you're one square away from a spot that the enemy can't track you to, then you can do that and be safe. If there's a door between you and you can close it, then that's safe. If you can get one of your other agents behind the person and then taser them, then that saves them. And there are loads of different things you can do to rescue them. Then if they do go down and you have a stim, or like a med gel, you can use it to revive them. If you don't have a med gel and they go down and you can't get a med gel, which is often you can, you can just pick them up and drag them to the exit and just leave. And then they'll heal back at base. Huh. So there are actually loads of ways. And even if they die, it's not game over. You can just carry on one agent if you like. So it's like pretty rare to actually completely wipe and just have your whole game fail. And that's kind of what I like about it, is there's so many ways to get out of sticky situations that they can make the game hard enough that you're kind of always in a sticky situation. Like, it's always difficult. You always feel like you're on the brink of disaster, but disaster wouldn't actually mean the game ends and you have to just go back to the start and get disillusioned and lose your immersion in it. So I'm always, like, really gripped by it. And I talked before about how it's building up, it's 72 game hours, yeah. And at the end of those, you do one final mission, and it's meant to be that the whole reason you're doing all these missions in between is that you need to build up your resources and get better equipment and stuff so that you're ready for this final mission, and then after that your whole agency's going to be shut down or something. Like, people are closing in on you and there's like a time limit to survive. And I didn't like that much, because it felt like I was so excited by the world and like the style of it. It feels like a sort of semi-retro, semi-futuristic spy agency, and I want to run one of those. Well, that's been my long-term job. I don't want to be like a 3-day temp job. And there is an Endless mode, and that's what I've been playing now. Basically, I did one more campaign after the last time I talked about it, and that went pretty well. I completed it, but I also learned a lot along the way because I was posting YouTube videos of it, and so I would, in the video, get pissed off about, why can't I fucking move past that stupid fucking drone, or what the fuck does corporate intelligence do? And then 3 days later, when I put it online, someone will say, oh, corporate intelligence doesn't get you any money, or you can walk past drones when they're unconscious, or stuff like that. So I know loads more about the game now, and I started Endless Mode, and I think I've got about 6 times better at it, like, immediately. And also Endless Mode, I don't know if it's more forgiving. I think maybe it's not, but it's just because your time is not a factor, you can kind of play it fast or slow depending on what suits you. So I've got a team where I'm using International and Shalom 11 is the name of the other guy. And International is the hacker lady, and Shalom is the gunman, basically. He used to be an assassin, and he comes with like his own special rifle right from the start. He's the only character who has a gun from the word go. And usually guns are kind of late-game things that used to take out drones and stuff. But he has one straight away, and he has like an AUG that gives him extra penetration with ranged weapons, which is really important when things have armor and you're up against robots. And I've given him a dart gun that can penetrate 2 layers of armor and recharges every 5 turns instead of needing any ammo, which means it's essentially free. The flurry gun, which also has armor penetration of 2, which is, I think, the best in the game, and can only be fired once per mission, but also has infinite ammo and recharges all the time. And he's kept his original rifle, so he has 3 guns. And I've also given him a second taser, so that he has 2 tasers, so that even when his taser's on cooldown, he can just use different taser to taser. And then International has like a level 3 taser thing, which knocks people out for nearly twice as long, and also it recharges in only 2 turns, and also she has an AUG that makes everything recharge in 1 turn faster, so it recharges effectively instantaneously. And she has 2 buster chips, which means she can hack things in person without spending any of your hacking juice, as long as she can get close to it. And then also, she can hack consoles to give you more power, and when she does that, she gets like 5 bonus power, and she's got a device that gives another 4 bonus power if she uses it on that console, so I can essentially like recharge my whole power bar in like 1 move almost. And she's got 2 syringes that paralyze people once they're down, so that once you knock them out, they'll stay out for longer. And basically, I just found all the best things in the game and then got 2 of them each. And it's fucking amazing. I'm like so excited about all the different combinations I can do with this. It's like, it already seemed, just from my previous experience with it, like all the systems were really kind of elegantly interlocked and just really compelling, and that seems to carry on even when you can play it endlessly. I think it's starting to get slightly too easy now. Like, I'm sort of ready for it to be a bit more challenging. I am playing on easy, so I could be playing on normal, but apparently in the full version they're going to make Endless Mode get harder, I guess. I don't know if it'll get harder faster or harder for longer, because right now there's a limit to how hard it can be, you know, because it's like difficulty 5 or something, and your agents kind of keep getting better to some extent. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to it coming out now.
When is it due to come out?
They're in the final leg, so they've been doing bi-weekly updates, and they've just stopped doing that about 2 weeks ago, so there isn't a new one now. And they said, we're stopping this because we need to actually finish the game and get like a bunch of polish stuff done and like the ends of the missions and stuff. I think they do have a date somewhere, which I can't remember, but we'll put that in the show notes. It's not too far off, I don't think.
Clay seem really good at making games. Have they made a bad one? Yeah.
Well, apparently, I remember Shanks not getting great reviews at the time. I've never played it.
Mm. Oh, man, I'd forgotten that was even there.
Yeah, going into Mark of the Ninja, they weren't sort of the what's the word? The
bookie's
favourite? Yeah, whatever.
The bookie's darling.
They weren't dating any bookies. And yeah, then Mark of the Ninja was brilliant, and then Don't Starve, and then this. Mm. And is there anything else?
No, I think that's it.
But yeah, they got a pretty good batting average now.
To confuse that analogy.
It's yet another analogy I know nothing about.
They've got a good rocking average.
I mean, Don't Starve multiplayer, I guess, is kind of a newish game.
Yeah. I haven't. Has anyone here played that at all?
No, I meant to. And then I meant to see whether you guys fancied it, and then I thought, I'll just die to bees anyway, because that's what I always do. I always get too close to a beehive and think, I'm just going to hit it the once.
Why would you even hit it the once?
Right. I know.
I think I've isolated your problem.
It's just there and it's so tempting and you need bees for things. I remember because I previewed it. I haven't played it since. Right. But there was a bee mine and you needed a bee to make the rest of this mine. You know, I had all the other ingredients and I just needed a bee. And then I was like, I don't really know how to get the bee at this point.
I think bee mine is one of the things you can get on a love heart.
It is. But yeah, so I remembered wandering around just trying to figure out the thing and then thinking, do you know what? I'm just going to whack it. And I died to bees. So, yeah.
What have you been playing at the moment?
I have been playing Apotheon. Which is that game about, well, it's a Greek vase sort of theme.
It's in the Greek vase genre.
It's actually a genre now.
Pottery genre.
Looks like a pot genre.
And it looks fantastic. And but when I actually played it, I was less fond of it than that. Mm. Although it's got that weird thing going on of the longer I don't play it, the longer since I played it, the more fond I am of it. Because all I remember is the prettiness rather than the combat, which I found sort of quite fiddly and annoying. So essentially what you've got is it's just a combat-oriented platformer kind of thing where you have a bunch of sort of melee and ranged weapons and projectile stuff, so fire pots that you throw and they can explode things or whatever, or health potions and whatnot, and I've forgotten the last category, but anyway, so there's four different categories, and what it was that they're bound to four different buttons, and then once you select the type of weapon you want, you then scroll up and down to actually find the one that you want, and then in the meantime you're sort of running around on screen trying to dodge the people who are shooting you, and shooting with arrows and whatever. It's very sort of faithful to the period, or throwing hatchets at your head.
Faithful to the pots of the period.
Exactly. And so I found that super unwieldy on mouse and keyboard, so I switched to a controller, which was a lot easier in terms of just the interface, but it still had some sort of weird quirks in terms of, auto-aim and stuff. So there were in some of the levels, so they were styled, again, obviously, if you know the sort of the black figure Greek pots, then you'll know what I mean, but essentially it's silhouettes of people and then layers of houses or layers of sort of scenery that you interact with, and so in some of those you could actually activate traps. You could throw one of your projectiles or use a ranged weapon to activate a thing that would drop rocks on someone's head or something like that. But I found that if the thing that you were then sort of waiting to get into range to activate the trap sort of stepped into range of your weapon, then it would just auto-target to that, and so you'd end up having to then try and target it back on the thing that you've been waiting patiently to use. And, so there were a few things like that that I just found awkward. And also when you're going from one floor to another, it's fine when you're going up because it always assumes that the uppermost thing is the thing you want to be standing on when you jump upwards through it. But if you're going down, you have to, press a thing that means that you actually fall through the floor while holding down and stuff. And occasionally that just sort of didn't quite work out, especially in the middle of a fight, and you'd be sort of trapped in a particular bit that you didn't want to be trapped in, things like that. So, and I know that's not an experience that everyone shared because they got in touch to tell me so, but it definitely got in the way of just the flow of combat and things. And so one of the things that I enjoyed when I was fiddling around and just practicing with stuff was that the weapons did feel different and you could sort of get a feel for the range and things. But when you were actually fighting stuff, I didn't find that that translated. I couldn't reliably always tell what I would hit with a thing, whether it would come within the range of that weapon or things like that. And the other thing that I found was that a lot of the boss fights, didn't really change up at all. You'd figure out what you had to do, and then you would just do that the entirety of the way down the boss's health bar. Mm. And they were all sort of gods and stuff, and some were sort of themed around what they did. But so I was fighting Poseidon, and all you do is you climb onto a boat and then you wait.
Checkmate Poseidon.
That's how it happened in history.
And you wait for Poseidon to like wade over to you, like flailing his trident around, and then you just hit him from on the boat for a while. And then like he might scoop the boat up and you might fly off, or you know, you might get knocked off or whatever. But you just climb onto the boat and hit him again. And it's that kind of thing that, like, you know, you get someone to half health and you're wondering if it's gonna change up a bit, and it's like, it doesn't.
It's a shame. You'd think it would be kind of not easy, but easier than normal to make boss fights out of Greek gods. Like, they already come with their differentiated set of abilities.
Some of them work super well. Like the Artemis one, which is one of the first ones you encounter, so I don't mind talking about it. But it's like you become she changes you into a deer, because she's the goddess of hunting, and so you run around and you have to activate these moon shrines as you go around, because she's also the goddess of the moon. And once you've done that a certain amount of time, you get to swap places and you get to hunt her, and that sort of really plays into the idea of sort of the gods using people as sport and sort of having the arrogance to think that they are always going to win. And that sort of really captures that spirit of things, I think, and does so really well. And I was really fond of that. But it comes and goes, I found.
Mm.
And so, you know, some of them is more forgivable. Like with Ares, you know, he's the god of war. You just bash him. You know, that's what you that's what you want, really, isn't it? But yeah, so I found that it was kind of patchy. And but having said that, like, you know, having not played it for, you know, a few days now, I'm sort of, what I remember is the atmosphere of it and the artwork. And so I sort of, there is a fondness. And I would say, you know, like, I've also bought it for a friend who I thought would super like it, but it's more of a niche thing, as in, you know, it sort of caters to a lot of her interests in a very particular way, rather than I would give it to any fan of sort of 2D combat.
Given that it's appeal seems mostly to be in how it looks in the world and stuff like that, rather than the actual combat, would I get all the pleasure out of it just by watching a video of someone else play it?
I think there is still value in playing it, I would say, but it irked as much as it pleased, I would say, and it wasn't a particularly satisfying experience. But it was one where I'm still glad that I played it rather than watched it, you know? I think it's probably one that I would happily watch, sort of sit on the sofa next to someone playing and sort of enjoy that, but then not be the one getting annoyed.
Mm-hmm. I think I played it 2 years ago in the IGF.
Oh, yeah.
So I think I've been working on it a long time. Because I remember having a similar opinion, to be honest. It was absolutely gorgeous, but I found the combat rather fiddly and it was just slightly irritating. It was quite, felt quite physics-y, but the physics didn't totally, like, conform to expectations in some way.
I was wondering whether, like, that was because the bodies that you have, they move in that slightly sort of, they're quite reminiscent of shadow puppet, like, articulated dolls, and I wondered whether that was somehow, you know, butting up against the physics of the game, and sort of that maybe is why it was hard to necessarily tell where the hit was going to land, or if you'd judged it quite right.
That developer's previous game was Capsized.
Oh yeah, I like that.
Which is fucking great. Capsized is a 2D combat platformer where you play a little spaceman stranded on an alien planet, and the art is beautiful, but it's very colourful and sort of pencil drawn and rich, and it's really physics-y, and the combat is the best thing about it, because it kind of has pretty much all of Quake's guns. Like, it's not going massively outside the wheelhouse, but it renders those guns in a 2D game better than they've probably been done elsewhere. And maybe that's it, like, their system of kind of like everything having these kind of like articulated physics-y bodies works brilliantly if you're blasting them with shotguns, but it doesn't really work for melee combat as well. Or, like, in Capsize, you've got jetpack and grappling hooks, and gravity's all over the place, and the idea is that the physics are a huge part of it, so you might rocket yourself into the air and then grapple hook something and fling around. Rocket jumping is in it, you know, all that kind of like Quake physics stuff. And that works really well. It works particularly well with the mouse and keyboard. In fact, I wouldn't play it with a pad, because it requires you to be able to aim in 360 degrees around your character really quickly. and I played a bit of this in an IGF build, but a later IGF build of the one Tom played. And I can sort of see that, I think, maybe without that, like, if you're fighting in the holds of ships or in Greek villages, it doesn't have the same sense of kind of, like, you know, low-gravity deathmatch stuff that they did in their previous game, even though structurally it's kind of similar.
Maybe that's a problem with the ancient Greeks for not being advanced enough. I mean, you know, if they're trying to be faithful to pot technology and pot artwork...
Yeah.
Then they can't really, you know, go with the source material.
They could have just, like, graffitied some vases to put, like, jetpacks and grappling hooks on it. Yeah. And, well, it's canon.
Sneaking into the British Museum at night, you know, just, like, daubing on a few extra sort of, you know, laser pistols.
Nail gun.
big old cacodemon on the Elgin Marbles.
Yes, that is what I have been playing.
What have you been playing, Chris?
I've been playing Sunless Sea, which I've now played a lot of. And I have complicated and mixed feelings about that game, which has otherwise been really well received.
I've heard it's the best game ever.
Yeah, well, to that extent. And I think... And so I really like it, but I have that feeling about it now where I see more of the faults than I see the things that I'd like about it. And so, I'm facing reviewing it at the moment, and it's kind of that thing of, like, trying to weed out the genuine good stuff in my head so that I can justify praising it. Because all I see at the moment are faults. So if this sounds unbalanced one way or another, kind of with that caveat, that I'm that far into it now that I'm kind of just seeing the stuff that annoys me. But, so it's an adventure game with procedurally generated elements and an element of permadeath, but it is not a roguelike. And the reason it isn't a roguelike is because it is substantially based on, like, authored stories that you encounter. And the randomness affects what order you might encounter stories in, but it doesn't have a procedural element. So, like, the reason I say it's not a roguelike is I could spoil it. Whereas you can't spoil Spelunky, you can't spoil Invisible Ink, you can't spoil anything. You know what I mean? Maybe you can give something big away from, like, a big secret in Spelunky. But fundamentally, if I explained anything what happened on any of the islands in Sunless Sea, I'd be giving something away.
Because then the difference between, I guess, mechanical spoilers versus... plot spoilers.
Yeah, like literally, you know, there are plot spoilers for almost everything you encounter in that game. But I should explain it. So it's set in the Fallen London universe, which is a kind of steampunk Victorian setting where London has sort of sunk underneath the ground in mysterious circumstances. And in the Fallen London browser game, you kind of build up a character and kind of follow storylines that kind of present themselves as sort of text adventures through different parts of that city and explore more and more about it, learn more about the world. This is set in the same world, but you are a Z captain, this underground ocean next to Fallen London, and you're a captain on a boat who, for your own reason, is set off to explore the Z. It's Z-E-E, but it's the C, basically. I don't know why the game isn't called Sunless Z, in fact that then wouldn't alliterate.
Isn't it short for Unterzee?
It's Unterzee, yeah. But yeah, like, for whatever reason. It's Fallen London. They could do word things if they want. And it's got a lot in there. There's a lot of, like, not a lot of Lovecraft necessarily, which is heavily influenced on it, but, like, a lot of Neil Gaiman. There's a lot of, like, writers that followed Lovecraft, and a decent amount of, like, you know, turn of the century fantasy, and it's all kind of pottled into this boiling pot of stories that sort of riff on different ideas about kind of horror and cosmic horror and survival and sort of, I don't know, magic and mysticism and the unknown and stuff. But it's fundamentally, in addition to being this sort of, like, naval exploration game from a top-down perspective, it is fundamentally also a story nexus game, which is the same engine that powers Fallen London and recently powered Dragon Age The Last Court, which was the game that Fail Better made for BioWare, or for EA. And it is a toolset that's otherwise available. And to understand how any of those games work, you kind of have to understand how story nexus works. How Story Nexus works is it's a kind of a structure for allowing the player to progress through interactive fictional text adventure style stories that adds essentially a resource collection and gambling mechanic to gate progress, which sounds like the driest way of putting it, but the notion is that as your character progresses through stories, they gain resources of various types. That might be physical stuff the character has, you know, equipment and goods and stuff, or it could be like abstract resources, like a good night's sleep. You might have one times a good night's sleep. You might have, or it might be a statistic associated with your character. They're never called something as simple as strength or charisma, but there are equivalents. So you'd have in your pocket, you've got 60 times charisma, a good night's sleep, and a rat. You know that. And as you encounter choices in the game, the choices that you have available to you are gated by what you've managed to gather. And this actually fits really naturally a browser game like Fallen London. In Fallen London, you kind of you're constantly gathering things in the manner of almost any Skinnerbox game. It's not it's substantially better written, but it's not mechanically a million miles from any browser game where you amass resources over time and spend them to get more resources from a system that gives you more resources. And in Fallen London, the browser game, you have action points that are limited, that replenish over time, and you can spend money to get action points faster or have a higher cap, and that's kind of how they make money from it, which is fine. And Fallen London's really good. And it's really good because the writing that surrounds that system is fundamentally quite basic, is really top-notch, like almost across the board. It's really consistent, really well edited, has a real strong sense of place, and the adventures, you kind of want to see the next story, or go in on a lunch break and cash in your next 20 action points, because it's continually interesting. And Sunless Sea has that as well. And when you arrive at an island in Sunless Sea, your interaction with the island is entirely through text prompts. It's very similar to Fallen London. You use the same sorts of resources, the same kinds of, you gain the same things from missions in terms of plot opportunities that amass in your inventory in the form of functionally items and that kind of thing. There are obviously some different ones to do with equipping your ship and having a crew and having officers and things like that, but the system, and that's what I wasn't expecting actually, because I didn't play Sun of the Sea when it was in early access, but I have played quite a lot of Fallen London. I wasn't expecting it to be so exactly the same system. And that stuff's all great. What they've changed is basically the mechanic by which you get new stuff to do. In Fallen London, you get new stuff to do by waiting or from drawing cards from a deck. And then as your proficiencies go up, you get access to more stuff you can do, and it expands and expands and expands. And so in Fallen London, the resources that you're expected to spend is time, basically. You wait time and you get more stories to play, and you can spend money to get more stories. This being a full price game, they've changed that to space, basically. It's the easiest switch ever to think about conceptually. Instead of, getting new options as you look at a series of menus in a browser, you now travel from island to island, and as you travel to different islands, you get new stuff, new adventures to explore, new stuff to do. And those islands are rearranged every time you start a new playthrough or your captain dies. And that's good, and actually exploring feels pretty risk-laden, atmospheric at start. You're constantly burning through supplies and fuel, and getting caught without those things can be a quick way to die, that kind of thing. And it feels a little bit more risk-laden than Fallen London does, where you're not really ever in threat of that kind of thing, and the fact that you can die at all is adds a different element to it. However, when it's not being Fallen London with a different way to unlock new stories to play through, it's not a brilliant game. The actual, just at the basic mechanical level of it, I've seen comparisons to FTL, which I presume is because it's got a ship in it and you can die, but it's not, like, the comparison doesn't hold at all, because FTL, in addition to being a game where you occasionally go through text prompts and you encounter a strange survivor on an asteroid or whatever, is also a strategy game, and a really full-fledged strategy game. And Sun of the Sea just isn't. Like, the combat system was thrown out during the early access and redone completely from a turn-based system to now a real-time system. I didn't play the old version, but the new one doesn't really work. So the notion is your ship comes in range or is spotted by an enemy, and you kind of get a fire radius around your ship. And similar to any naval combat game ever, you turn, try and get a firing solution. Your cannons or deck guns recharge on a timer, and whenever you can fire, you want to line up, fire, and then hopefully stay out of the other guy's line of fire. That's how pretty much every ship-to-ship combat game ever has worked. But broadly speaking, there are two types of enemies in the game. There are Z-monsters, like giant crabs, living icebergs, flocks of bats, sharks with wearing clothes or something.
Damn clothes sharks.
They're like bound sharks. They're covered in
sharks,
like straps.
In cravats or something.
Yeah, they're covered in straps and stuff. It's Fallen London stuff. It's fine. What they want to do is they want to charge you. And so they will circle a bit, and then they will slow down, and then they'll speed up, and they'll charge you. And their routine is very samey. And your chance for success against them is, do I have enough armor and damage to kill them before they kill me? because there's not a lot of avoiding them, really. You just, you know, sometimes they submerge and you can use items to bring them back to the surface, but really, the single overriding thing is my ship powerful enough? And if it isn't, you run away. And if it is, you fight them and beat them. So the chances for success is almost entirely determined what you do outside of combat. And so I just avoid them 100%. Like, I put all my stats into the thing that makes me harder to spot to enemies, because there is no point fighting them. Like, you get some stuff for destroying them, but really, it's too much risk. And the price for dying is too high, or, you know, it's high because it probably should be. Therefore, don't bother. The other type of enemies are other boats, so pirates, or if you want to become a pirate yourself, you see a couple of non-pirate ships going around. And unfortunately, the AI is incapable of making that any meaningful challenge. So, like, I really quickly realized that in your first ship, your turning circle is pretty good. Your turning circle is good enough that you can always be inside the turning circle of whoever you're fighting. So if you switch your lights off, get up to a ship behind it, doesn't matter how tough it is, doesn't matter how late game the ship is, doesn't matter, you know, if it's got 300 health and your ship has 75 and its guns do loads of damage and yours do nothing, you'll stay behind it and you'll eventually destroy it. It has no way out of that. The AI can't do it. It will just turn left forever. And you just turn left forever as well. And they also get stuck on the scenery all of the time. If you fight a ship near an island, there's a really good chance it will just drive into the island and kind of stop and waggle trying to get out again, and you just stay behind it and you destroy it. And that created in a game that's so much about resource management, I've got to this point now where even though I had this idea in my head of the fantasy, and it's a game that's all about giving the freedom to express who you want to be in this world, I would maybe want to not a complete pacifist run, but to see myself as someone who just sort of slips by the pirates and goes off to explore somewhere else, doesn't necessarily stop the fight, you know, doesn't get a reputation for being bloody-minded, but any ship that's hostile is free loot. That's just the way the game is balanced. Like, that is free, that's a chance at free supplies and free fuel, and you can't really pass that up. And that, for me, that's, it's not a deal-breaker, but it's a really pronounced weakness of what the game's trying to be. It feels like with the quality of the writing being as high as it is, and it is, the reason I'm dwelling on it is because, honestly, you spoil things the moment you start talking about it. But I get to that separately. You want the game that links those stories to feel as meaningful. You want the outcome of your last fight to change the kinds of decisions you make when you land on an island, because maybe there's a horrible decision you have to make that might give you more supplies or more fuel, but you burn through your fuel escaping that scary pirate you had to run away from. You want the systems to talk to each other in that way. And the combat is so, just the AI is not good enough to make combat interesting, because combat isn't interesting. It has a knock-on effect on how interesting other stuff becomes. Like, I'm almost constantly maxed out on supplies and fuel now, because I've gotten just really good at killing humans because their AI is bad, and good at avoiding everything else, and seeing when it's time to avoid it. You know, I've unlocked 60% of the map with the starter ship, and without dying. And, like, it's that kind of thing where it's like, there's another balance pass that's necessary, or it needs, I don't know, like, just because I don't know the circumstances in which combat was redeveloped, but the fact that it's been redeveloped from scratch gives me less confidence in it. And you kind of want there to be a whole person whose only interest in that game is like, I just want to make a cool ship combat game, and the rest of the team can go off and do all the narrative stuff they want in perpetuity. You just want someone involved to only be interested in making the ship combat as good as it can be, so that the rest of the game benefits from that, and that's a real weakness at the moment. The other thing that's kind of weird about it is that it's got permadeath in it, because there's stuff about that that is kind of a bit weird. And the reason it's a bit weird is because when you die, and this is a nice idea, when you die you kind of choose who your successor is. You pick your next captain based on the circumstances of your last one. So it can be like a rival or a former crewmate or whatever, and which one you pick allows you to take one thing into the next life. So I had an officer I really liked, for example, which is like basically a companion character. You get some dialogue options, stuff like that, that I really liked, which meant that, and I knew that if I picked that my new captain is a crewmate of my former one, then I can take that officer and keep them with you. And you kind of, I guess, you're encouraged to imaginatively kind of assumed that, oh, I guess that crewmate survived and saved that officer and they've started their own ship. But the problem is that while a few things change, a lot of the narratives will just reset at that point. The islands reshuffle, but when you go to those islands, you're still experiencing the same stories as you did the first time around. And Fallen London has had an element of that to it. It's always had an element of repetition to it, and a degree to which it's quite kind of mercurial with how time works, or whether everyone is experiencing the same stories in the same way, or, you know, there are often opportunities where it just gives you the chance to, even within the context of a single playthrough, replay exactly the same scenario multiple times. But that system whereby the islands get remixed, but you find yourself re-encountering exactly the same scenarios over and over again as ostensibly different characters in the same continuum, kind of compound this sense that, and I got this with Fallen London as well, that eventually you will start to game those systems. So, for example, now I know that there's a place where you can go there, and providing you have an action to spend, which is a different system you get by just sailing around, you can either get one supply or one Tale of Terror, which is a resource, a story that you basically carry around with you. And there are narrative trappings of those things, but I've been to the island so many times now and seen those two options, which are functionally talk to the locals about this thing or have tea with the locals, that I don't really see them in those terms anymore. You kind of naturally start to skip the story stuff, which is the real kind of meat of the game, and move just on to, kind of need supplies this run, don't need Tales of Terror, I'm just going to take the supplies this time. And I think the way Fallen London evades that is because it eventually you level up again, or you get above a certain threshold in your persuasion or whatever, and you get whole new stuff to do, and you see all new stuff again. And some of the sea manages it as long as you are pushing out, and pushing out, and pushing out, and pushing out, and they are updating it constantly as well, and adding new islands, which is a good idea, but it's not the reliable kind of permadeath, where you die, but then you're kind of excited to see what new stuff you have this time. In this, you die, and you kind of are set back, regardless of which one thing you take, you're set back at the bottom of a kind of a narrative system that you've now seen through a few times, and that is a weird... It's a weird creative position to be put in, because you want to keep imaginatively engaging with it, but reading what people have to say about it and reading these kind of wonderful stories of how powerfully they engage they are with a one choice they're asked to make, the thing I wanted to say is, how will you feel about that the way the third time the game makes you make that choice? Because that will always happen. And that's not you replaying the game for your own pleasure. That's by design that you will see that choice three times.
Hmm.
You know, there's... You're encouraged to make serious decisions because they allow you to get an heir, and having an heir, a kid... gives you different options when you die, and allows you to pass on more. So there's a gameplay incentive, a resource incentive, to kind of mining out the dialogue trees a bit to find the one that gives you a kid. And some of that stuff is kind of like powerfully written and really beautifully kind of put the first time you encounter it. And the second time it's, this is the way I get a kid, and if this run goes wrong, this is a way for me to shore up some resources.
FTL has those, they are like written as if they're specific story moments when you like take one of those text dialogues and make a decision, and you do repeat those loads, and you do get a sense for the mechanical ways they play out. Like, I've played FTL a lot, so now I know when I encounter this particular option, oh, you always attack the slavers, because then when they surrender, they'll give you some slaves, and that's a really big deal. But they were like, I think just because they were very short and they were never the point of the game, the fact they repeat so often didn't feel weird to me. It wasn't like, oh, this one again, fuck this. It was like, oh, cool, slaves. I like slaves. So, like, it's sort of, I don't know, it was intentional, but it ended up feeling like those are more like placeholders for, like, you encountered a situation that mechanically boils down to the slaver thing again, and it didn't feel annoying that it was, you know, written as if it was a story.
Yeah, but I guess...
I'm guessing this is too specific and too narrative. Well,
it's because narrative is the point, and I do feel kind of bad for, like, taking the game apart for what I see as its structural and design flaws, when, like, the writing is as good as it is. And it's, like, it's, you know, it's better written and more evocative and more inventive than the vast majority of games that you'll play. And every island has some cool new idea. Like, I can give you an example without spoiling the whole thing, but, like, there's an island, and all the islands are, like, have different art as well, so you approach the island and you're like, what the fuck is that? And, like, you know, for top-down games don't often manage the degree of feeling of, like, what the hell is that? That a first-person game or something where you're constantly looking towards the horizon might, but it manages that by, like, you arrive at an island and half of the island is this enormous stone face staring up at the sky, or staring up at the roof of the fantasy, I guess. And you get there, and it turns out this is an island where everyone has to wear a mask at all times. Visitors are given a mask. But not only that, they're expected to play the role that the mask gives for them. So if you pick the frog mask, the frog is expected to be a bit of a buffoon, and you can get in real trouble if you're not a bit of a dick while you're wearing the frog mask, and then you get into a kind of an intrigue that involves swapping masks, and but everyone's playing different roles, and there's lots of different ways through that scenario. And that one, it's a text adventure at that point. It's a, you know, it's a, it could be a Twine game, and it, but it's still a really good one, and it's really fun and interesting, and you know, there's there's a part that changes based on when you had to have a flare with you when you went in, and there's, you know, it does really cool things like that, and that's great. But it's so detailed and so intricate and so beautifully put that it then subsequently can weaken it on repetition, because it stops being this sort of emblematic thing like the slaver encounter in FTL, where it's simple enough to just be seen as, oh, it's that again.
Do the islands change up with time?
They move.
So as you, but I mean, in terms of what you're saying, you know, like, for example, in Fallen London, once your persuasion gets beyond a certain point, you sort of start unlocking different options. So if you go back to an island having got a whole bunch more resources or having got a bunch more experience, would you, is there anything that is more, that is available to you that wasn't before?
As far as I can tell, there are islands that definitely require you to go back multiple times with new stuff. But it tends to be because there's a linear plot line on the island that when it's finished, it's finished. And some of them you can do the first time you arrive. Some of them you get there and you kind of unpick it slowly and you make multiple journeys and you include it in your routes as you explore. And because the game is kind of conducted in these kind of trips to and from Fallen London itself, which get further as you get more proficient at exploring and you understand more of the map. And you start to steer yourself around different places to kind of, you know, to maybe, oh, this time I've got a crate of souls with me, so I'm going to feed it to that devil that wanted those souls. And you can, and things can chain into each other as one quest gives you a reward that's related to a different one that kind of steers you around the map. But I've never seen an island be substantially different. I've changed islands through my interaction with them, but then it's sort of, they change into like their final state where, you know,
it starts to feel like, or it feels like it would, if I was playing that, I would start to feel like I was sailing around a museum.
It has that to it a little bit. There are,
like, a beautiful, interesting, well-told museum.
I think it's entirely because its value comes from stuff that someone's had to write. And they are adding new stuff. You can, if you log into your Fallen London account from the main menu, it just pulls down a whole new stories. And every time you load it up, it says, hey, I've got some new stuff. Do you want to let me download the new stuff? And I believe them, because their content is so, like, fucking industry-ish, but, like, it's quite, quote-unquote, cheap to produce, because it's a lot of 2D art that's reused and text. So in terms of putting new stuff in there, it's way more achievable than it would be in a different type of game where they've got to do loads of assets and animation and all that kind of thing. So I can believe them that they can keep it fresh by adding new stuff, but it's a really different proposition to having a game that at its basic level is mechanically capable of generating that stuff. And I think it's a missed opportunity because I don't, you know, and it's fully possible it's not setting out to be that type of game, but it has upgrading a ship, combat, that kind of thing, and all that stuff is below par. And that's, like, if in the FTL example, when you encounter those slavers, you might know that attacking them is the best thing to do because you understand that's how you get the best reward, but there's going to be a scenario where you arrive there having just fled a different fight.
Yeah, you're on fire.
And you're just like, I'm skipping this one because, yeah, like, I just can't handle it right now. Or you, you know, you kind of make a different decision based on the fact that you're really well geared or something else. So, you know, like, it all, like, FTL's narrative, how you progress through the narratives in FTL is fundamentally powered by a systems-driven strategy game, basically, that's underneath the surface. Whereas, I mean, there are tiers of equipment that I haven't got access to in Fallen London yet, but I am 12 hours in, and it hasn't revealed any strategic depth. And it's never made me, it's never made a story more interesting because of a fight that I've had. It's only killed me, or I've survived. And yeah, if you take some damage, you have to spend supplies to pause and repair your ship. But that's just,
it's just a nuisance rather than something that makes
yeah.
it more interesting.
Okay.
And like, you can, and there are moments where you know, like, and you know, your terror ticks up over time. So if you're traveling out with the light off to stay hidden, your crew gets scared faster, and that can lead to things. But, and maybe this is just a balancing thing, I've never had that ever be a problem. Like, I've managed to keep my, I got a tattoo and that brought my terror right down.
Does it glow in the dark?
No, it's just rad. but yeah, like, I think it's really good, and it's so different that I would recommend people played it if they were interested in the narrative side. But I also think it's a tremendous missed opportunity. Like, there's a version of this game where the combat system's super good in itself, you know, where it would work just as a ship combat game, where it's like genuinely amazing because you've got this half of it that's like super engaging strategy game that powers an amazingly written narrative thing, but it's 50% of that.
Can I ask, does it tap into the Fallen London stuff at all? As in, given I have a Fallen London account, will it take anything from that in the building of my Sunless Sea world if I start playing that?
Not as far as I know. I haven't seen anything.
I only tried it like once.
The reason I talk about I played it for about 3 hours and then started over. So rather than starting over with it, dying and starting a new captain, I actually started again because I'd annoyed myself because I named my first captain the same thing as my Fallen London character because I had this idea in my head that maybe it's my Fallen London character gone to sea for a bit. But not only did he die, but it felt so incompatible with the experiences that I've had in Fallen London that they don't do any, like, at that time actually my Fallen London character had been sent to the tomb colonies because no one dies in Fallen London. You just decay and eventually you just get wrapped up in bandages and sent to cities, especially for people who are gross, pretty much the tomb colonies. But my character had basically smoked too much opium and done too many scandalous things, and his scandal stat had risen to the point where I was exiled to the tomb colonies for a long time. And I went to those tomb colonies in Sunless Sea, which was a neat to actually see geographically where you would go. But like, there was no, you know what I mean? Like that, if they were going to do any tie-ins there, there'd be a reference to like, and there's this guy you know hanging around here.
Yeah.
They could have done that, but I don't think that's necessary really. Like it is standalone in its own.
Oh yeah. I was just curious. Yeah. Especially given, you know, there is time that I have put into that particular game within the same universe. So it'd be cool to.
It is an opportunity to see parts of, they've used it to flesh out parts of the story that you only hear references to in Fallen London.
Okay.
You can go to the surface, which is rad. Which is really different when you go to just regular ass Naples and you tell stories about under the sea and no one believes you. Well, it's not regular ass Naples, it's like steampunk 1880s. Anyway. No idea at the moment what score I'm going to give it, because it's like, this is really, really well written and beautiful and atmospheric and the music's lovely.
10 out of 10. And then never give another score.
Just scrolls in time. Just get out of it that way.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky. I guess the thing is, like, yeah, should it tie into Fallen London? Don't know. Don't know if that would make it a different game. Should it have more substantial gameplay mechanics in addition to the story stuff? Probably yes.
Should we do questions?
From questions?
Yes.
All right.
Okay, then.
That's where they came from. Dear Crispy Cake Bites, I just got a pair of Sennheiser HD598s, the ridiculous headphones with bits of wood on them for no apparent reason. They sound very lovely indeed with music, but they've blown me off my feet by making all game audio about a million times better. I've accidentally got a good sound chip on my motherboard. Happens to the best of us. So they're really good at giving my guns especially really satisfying noises. The AR2 in Half-Life 2 has an incredible amount of whoomph, and almost every weapon in Mass Effect 3 is a joy to use, to the extent that I'm playing through the whole thing again just for the sounds. My Geth assault rifle is called Susan, and she's a throaty wench. Here's my questions. One, have you ever had a peripheral that made a much bigger difference to a game than you were expecting? And two, have you got a favourite gun sound in video games? Hoping you sound extra Scottish through my headphones this week, Stan.
Just all of you sound Scottish now.
Something wrong with your headphones.
I wanted to ask this because when I was playing Prince of Persia, the very original one, the 2D first game in that series, on my IBM 286 or whatever it was, I think the sound was just like, do you remember you were supposed to select PC speaker? And that meant literally there was just a buzzer on your motherboard that could make a beep, and that was it. And that was our sound. And then we got a Sound Blaster card one day, and it completely transformed. I had no idea there would be any difference at all. I thought it would just be like louder beeps. There's like, if you run and jump, and if you're like on the same level and you just miss the jump, you can hang on to the ledge. Mm. But if you fall, and then you hang on to a lower ledge, like you fall a couple of meters and then hang on, or in my case, like, you know, 30 metres and then hanging on, you hear like the tendons in your arm rip. It's like kind of squelch, you go as you grab on. It was horrific. I had no idea I was doing that to my character before this.
Cool. All the peripheral stuff for me that's changed games has been obvious things like steering wheels and analog sticks. Oh, like, yeah. Like underneath my desk, I can't flip my feet anymore because I just got steering wheels and two flight sticks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The most recent one I bought specifically for Elite Dangerous, and then I haven't played Elite Dangerous in like a month and a half now or something like that. But I don't regret the purchase because it completely changed the feeling of playing the game.
Favorite gun sound, anyone?
Half-Life shotgun, maybe. Actually, possibly any of the guns in Wolfenstein: The New Order. That game has fucking amazing sounding guns. It's just got fucking amazing guns. They really understood something about it.
We should have canvassed Alice. She has very strong opinions about this. Alice O'Connor.
I like the shotgun in Fear. It's one of my favourite shotgun noises.
Shotguns in general are...
Yeah,
games. We ended up, when we did our PC Gamer Alternative Game of the Year Awards at the end of last year, I gave Wolfenstein's shotguns most shotgunny shotgun, which should be a category every year, honestly, because it's legit one of the most consistent joys of killing things in computer games.
Really like the gravity gun that just throws noises.
Hmm.
I think it would be a weapon that would be really easy to make feel kind of limp or weird, because it's just an object hovering in front of you, but it completely sells the idea that it's the gun that's doing it, just through the kind of it's kind of like a bit of tissue paper or a comb that someone's blowing into.
But yeah, it's a kind of heavy buzz, isn't there, while it's holding something, and then when you fire it, it's got a pop-up. Mark Quain writes, hi guys, I've recently bought Darkest Dungeon on Steam, and it's frustrating the hell out of me. I love games that are about making mistakes and just carrying on, XCOM, Crusader Kings, Fire Emblem, but I only like carrying on with mistakes that I'm okay with making. For example, if my best soldier in XCOM gets killed out of nowhere, I'll reload the game. But if someone dies in a poignant fashion, or the mistake leads to something interesting, I'll carry on. Yes, I know I'm a terrible person. Darkest Dungeon doesn't allow you to do this. It forces you to play on no matter what happens, because instead of allowing you to save, it will constantly quick save after every event. My question then, do you think games should sometimes force a player down a certain way of playing to hold on to a strong identity of what the game is, or should every game allow different approaches, and in this example, come with an option to quick save for horrible cowards like me? Kind regards, Mark.
I think it should come with an option to turn quick saves off. For years, I would save scum, this is what this is called, where you reload an old save, in Football Manager, or rather Championship Manager, when a result didn't go my way in a particular match, I didn't like that, and so I would think, that's not what happened. Speaking of Prince of Persia, it's like whenever you would die in that, and you would go, wait, that can't be right. Load in the old save. And then at a certain point in one of the Championship Manager games, they got rid of the ability to do that. Like, you couldn't load an existing save without first saving your current game. In which case, you would just alt F4 to close the system to force quit the game.
Yeah, I've done that.
And I think maybe at some point they blocked you from doing that as well, so you would have to go into the task manager to task quit. But then they've kind of reverted in recent versions now, where Football Manager just gives you the option when you go to load, it just says your current game is not saved. Do you want to save it first before you load another game? Because I assume that they know that a lot of people play the game this way. But what I decided a couple of months ago with Football Manager 2015 is I would play a career and not do any saves coming at all. And my first season with Manchester United went okay. I came third and I won the FA Cup. My second season, I was sacked after a few months because I was 17th in the league. It was all going to shit. And then I got a job at Bayern Munich and I'm doing really well with them. And there have been a bunch of situations where things have gone wrong in a way that normally I would be compelled to load an order save. Like, it's partly the nature of Football Manager, in that you can't tell a lot of the time which of your decisions are having any impact, which is just a random number generator. It's a complete fucking headfuck, that game. And a lot of the time, it's just, you sort of think, this is an easy game. I can't be bothered sitting through watching the match engine play this out. I'm just going to use the instant result button and get it to auto resolve. And then suddenly you lose 5-1 and you're like, oh, fuck's sake, that one! I would have done better than that if I'd been taking it seriously. I'm going to go back and do this properly. And so a lot of the time it's that sort of stuff. So I'm not doing that this time, and things have gone to shit and now they're going okay. I'm not having any more fun with it than I was before, and I don't think the stories I'm having out of it are any more interesting than the stories that I carve with it when I take more control over it and say, no, I don't want that shitty thing to happen.
Actually, everything went perfectly for me forever.
And so it's like, it's a different experience, but I don't think it's a better experience.
When you do save scum in it, do you have stories where things go wrong and you recover from it?
Yeah, there's certain types of failure which I'm okay with that I just let go, certainly.
Right.
There's a lot of different stuff that can go wrong or right in that game.
It's interesting because there aren't many games where like the user is never really trusted to allow any negative things into their experience. Like, usually a game would never give you the option to eliminate all bad things if they wanted you, if they thought that was part of the appeal. They would always want to force you to do that. But I think, like, it's possible to make a game where the user, the player, gets to decide what kind of story they want it to be and let things go wrong.
Mm.
There are, it's true that, like, a large percentage of players will just never let anything go wrong. But I wonder, if they did that and then it turned out boring, would they try again? Would they see that, you know, letting some things go wrong can be a better story?
Somersea actually has kind of an elegant system for this, whereby by default it autosaves constantly and you can't low save at all, so it's constantly just saving over. Unless it crashes or you're at F4, you're kind of back to your last, you know, a couple of seconds before you last made a decision. But at any time you can press escape and create a manual save, which is presented not just as present a manual save, but it's switch game to forgiving mode. From that point onwards, it allows you to make and load manual saves. But it removes an item from your inventory, your kind of list of things, which is this token that you carry as long as you haven't used that option. And the implication is that you get like a slightly better ending if you don't do that.
Hmm.
But otherwise, you can do it at any time, and this item, which is of no other worth to you, gets taken away. But it does sort of, it's a subtle indication that this is not how we want you to play the game, but it doesn't stop you from doing it if you'd rather not deal with death or whatever.
Yeah, I always think that's the way to solve these design problems. It's like, you don't have to penalise the player for not doing it, particularly because the players who want to use those functions are often the ones who are struggling the most, so you don't actually want to give them a mechanical disadvantage. But if you just give them, like, just a grade, just like a little gold star that appears on their screen if they don't do it, then anyone who possibly can not do it will try and not do it. But the ones who really do need it will still use it.
Hmm.
People love gold stars. I actually think Invisible Ink handles this really well. It does save all the time, but once per mission, you can click rewind, and it takes you back to the start of your last turn, which is pretty much always enough to undo a mistake. And they say, because their audience is super hardcore and super... they're all amazing at the game, and they wish it was 10 times harder. They're very sensitive to ever appearing to be too forgiving. Even though I think it's an incredibly forgiving game. They describe it as, it's a thing for if you misclicked, if you accidentally, like some interface problem caused you to screw up. We know you would never make a real mistake. We know you're all perfect, godlike players, but should the interface in some way screw you over purely because of our fault, then here's this thing, this way of going back. And still, like, a lot of their hardcore fans, like, turn it off, because even if I misclick, I want to have to deal with the fucking consequences of this. But for me, it's like all of Invisible Ink's forgiving, like, failure mechanics. It's one of those things where, when you need it, it saves the whole game and means it's not game over and you get back to it and everything's fine. But when you don't need it, it doesn't feel like, oh, this is easy because I haven't even used my rewind. You just forget you have a rewind. And it feels really tense, like, shit, I could have lost one of my agents there, that would have been awful. And then you forget that if you had lost your agent, you could have just rewound and undone it. And on my latest playthrough, I haven't used it at all, and I did fuck something, I did genuinely misclick something, and it was bad, but it hasn't gone totally wrong, and so I thought briefly, should I use my rewind? And then, nah, it's not actually that bad, I can recover from this. And it's probably better for it. Chris Owen writes, dear Great Crates and Subpar Crowbars, listening to this week's podcast, I got obsessed with the sound of Infinifactory and decided it sounded amazing and I simply had to play it. However, as I'm currently one of the unlucky few stuck in the recent Virgin Media to TalkTalk migration, I've been left without internet connection. To satisfy my urge to play this awesome-sounding game, I decided I would log into my Steam account at work, purchase the game, download it, and then copy the game files to a USB stick to take home. At which point I found out that offline mode only works on Steam if you had it remember your password when you were logged in with a connection, which of course I hadn't. This meant I had to hook up a range-boosting wireless antenna to my computer, booting it up without the driver signatures due to my dodgy wireless drivers, put the antenna as close as possible to my bedroom so I could pick up a sliver of signal from my mobile hotspotted iPhone, which was precariously balanced on a wardrobe so I could pick up as much 3G as possible, all just so I could log into Steam long enough for it to realise I had a new game and I had everything I needed to play it. Long story short, awesome game and well worth the effort. But it got me thinking, what's the biggest frustration you've ever had to go through just to play a game? Keep up the great work, Christian Staffordshire.
That is actually pretty much an Infinite Factory puzzle in itself, which is kind of rad.
I didn't have an answer to this, but I just loved the story so much I wanted to read it.
I can think of a lot of like older MMOs that would involve like 5 different proprietary login systems and like loads of like using a dial-up connection to briefly ping through whatever kind of third-party European networking portal that you use to let you access the game servers in America and all that kind of shit. But luckily I've blocked enough of that stuff out now that I can't remember any specifics.
It's not really the same thing, but when we were due to get Deus Ex Human Revolution review code, I'd gone home to play it once it was ready, because that was the best way to do it, and we didn't know when it would unlock, and neither did Square Enix. It was just like, I was waiting for days on end, like doing work, but just like small jobs that I could stop at any time if it did actually unlock. And then it finally like got authorized on Steam, but then I had to download, and it was going to take like, it was due to finish at like 4 a.m. And so I went to bed at like 6 p.m. that day, and then woke up at 4 a.m. and it wasn't done. Woke up at 5 a.m. and it wasn't done. Woke up at 6 a.m. and it wasn't done. And then woke up at 7 a.m. and it was done. And then played it for like a week.
Aww.
I think I had something like this guy, because what was his name? Chris.
Chris.
And I had something like, I was supposed to be reviewing something for RPS, but my internet went down, and so for some reason Steam wouldn't register that I had it, and like that was the most frustrating thing, because no one could tell me when the internet would come back up, so I couldn't like get on with the review. So I thought, I'm just going to de-stress and I'm going to play some Dragon Age Inquisition, because I'd only just started playing that as well. And Origin does this thing where I think it's that you have to go online to enable offline mode. And I was like, you are fucking kidding me. Like, where is the sense in that? What possible sense can that possibly... I am so angry right now. And I sort of, you know, and because I was offline and I think I'd burnt through a whole bunch of phone data, like, that just necessitated stomping around the house and, like, telling my housemate's cat how angry I was about all of these things, and that cat doesn't care. That cat was probably delighted. So yeah, that was pretty frustrating. And the other thing was, I bought and preloaded BioShock Infinite, but I'd misread the specs, so I didn't actually have like a laptop that was capable of playing it. So I'd spent ages downloading it and then waited and was really excited and then couldn't get it to play, but I thought that I'd read it, all the specs and stuff, and I thought it would be fine, and then it wasn't. So I uninstalled it, redownloaded it, which took another, like, I don't know, like, fucking 10 hours or something insane. And that didn't work. So, and then I finally realised my error. So I had to go to Sainsbury's to buy a copy, like, in real life, because I wasn't sure when I was actually going to get a PC at that point.
To the Xbox at this point, right?
Surely.
Yes. Yeah, no, sorry, like, my brain is just completely... Yeah, no, so I went to get an Xbox copy, and then I got ID'd. It's just like, are you kidding me? I'm like, what was it, like 29 at that point? It's like, oh, just come on, I'm getting a cauliflower and BioShock Infinite. Just let me leave.
So all the 14-year-olds do.
Yeah. It's like playing some
cosplay. So that was a palaver.
Has anyone played Dragon's Dogma?
No.
In that case, that is the answer to your question, Mark Thorne. Won't read the rest of it. Vanilla Nougar writes, given the success of Metro 2033 and Stalker, why are there not more FPSs inspired by books?
there aren't enough Russian science fiction novels. The only books that you can make FPSs from.
Are those the only FPSs based on books? Nobody knows.
Nothing springing to mind. Also, I've just thought that Chris Owen could be a lady, so if that is the case, I'm sorry I referred to you as he.
I don't know if books make great FPSs necessarily.
No.
Does Stalker closely follow the roadside picnic story?
No, no. It doesn't. No. Stalker doesn't really even follow the movie Stalker that was based on Roadside Picnic. It's like, I guess, you know, it's people have taken settings that are a bit like stuff from books.
I mean, so Stalker,
I'd like an FPS based on Paddington or something. It's like he's a bear with a railgun.
That's not really.
I'm not sure how that is. That's a bit true about it.
So Stalker is the railway station.
Fraggington Bear.
There was a book, then there was a movie of Stalker, and they made the game kind of more like the movie, I guess. And that happens all the fucking time. No shortage of games of movies that were once books. There were Harry Potter games, for example. I believe that was once a book.
Are any of the Tom Clancy games based on an actual Tom Clancy novel rather than just?
Hmm.
I think Tom Clancy has a concept.
That's interesting.
I read some stuff about him and his like game involvement, because he set up Red Storm, didn't he?
Mm.
And named after like one of his least successful books. But then apparently he got like a writing credit on all the games, but he didn't actually write any of them.
No.
I
know there were books based on the games, but there's not like a Rainbow Six book or something like that.
Yeah, there is a Rainbow Six book. Oh, at the same time, he wrote, I think, to like simultaneous release.
Burst in through two doors at the same time.
I can't remember whether...
Looking through the window, game through the door. Was.
I don't think... I think all of the games were original in that sense. Like, at worst... It was simultaneous with a book that he also wrote.
There's Call of Cthulhu: Dark Corners of the Earth, which is not, well, it's not the story of the game. It does not on the whole match a Lovecraft story, but it is a pastiche of lots of really specific moments from Lovecraft fiction. Like famously, the end of Shadow of Rensmith is done in kind of almost exactly at the end of that in that game, which is cool. But I guess that's a horror thing, and horror's more likely to have literary roots because it's horror and it's a more traditional literary genre than shooting things.
See, I've been trying to think, and all I could come up with really was stuff like GoldenEye, but obviously that's more from the film than it is the book.
So. Yeah, Pierce Brosnan wasn't in the book.
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's that sort of once removed thing that Tom was talking about with the Harry Potter stuff.
Yeah.
Mind you, when I said that, I was forgetting we're talking about FPSs. I don't actually know of any Harry Potter FPSs. Well,
first person wand.
There might be, I suppose. We had one earlier that was going to combine here. Oh, yeah. James writes, "Dear Rum and Reason, this week Eurogamer finally admitted that RPS was right all along, and putting numbers on reviews is a bad idea. How long until PC Gamer sees the light?" And then also, from Scoo on Twitter, "Are games review scores done for? I hope not."
So Graham is the editor-in-chief of RPS. How do you feel about scores?
I like scores.
Me too.
RPS was right all along, just in general.
Is this a good time for me to bring up my idea that we see what Metacritic does when you just assign either a random score to something or something that doesn't work on its scale, like irrational numbers or like negative numbers or... things that are, you know, -1. How are you going to deal with that?
Score everything out to 0 so that when they try and calculate it, they get a divide by 0. Your face, Metacritic.
Exactly. I just want to sort of see what they do with that, you know?
Metacritic will list reviews that don't have scores on them if you're willing to let them. They'll assign a score to your text based on their reading it and going,
do they have actual people who do that? Or do you have to read through it and say, if this had a score,
you
this
don't
is
do
what
it.
I
they must
do
it. They must have someone.
Yeah, Eurogamer said that they are sort of pulling out of Metacritic wholesale, so they are not. They specifically mentioned like they're not letting Metacritic, you know, assign a mysterious score to their reviews, and also they're not willing to do it themselves. So I guess both is an option.
I'm kind of worried for them that Metacritic will just take their Google thing. because in order to stay in Google, they've retained Google's star ranking system. So for their purposes, because they now have three scores, basically. No, hang on, they have four. They have no score, which is kind of average.
Yeah.
Don't buy this, which is bad. Like, highly recommended, essential and recommended.
It's essential, avoid, recommended, and just nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's what they've... Snog, Mario,
or avoid.
Snog, Mario, avoid, or I refuse to. Yeah.
Or 3,000 word review.
And so what they've done to, I think, to maintain the position of Google, which this makes total sense because Google's essential for running a website.
I would say it's recommended.
Nice. What they've done is when a Eurogamer review comes up in Google now, a don't buy this comes up as one star. Recommended comes up as four stars. Essential comes up as five stars. And all other reviews come up as three stars. But I kind of worry that Metacritic will just go, "Hi, you are putting scores on them," and you know, we'll just take them.
We can meta that.
Yeah, they totally can meta that. It's just that all reviews are six now. Like,
it sounded like they'd actually talk to them. Like,
I imagine they probably have, but I don't know. Like, aggregate is going to aggregate, man.
I think you can. I mean, Metacritic at one point asked RPS if they could aggregate our reviews, basically, and RPS said no. So, and they never did. You know, so I assume you can opt out in some way, and they won't be dicks about it. Maybe they will be dicks about it now, especially if there is that Google star rating, and they just think.
I feel like,
especially if there's maybe a sense of the beginning of a pushback against them, especially from a site that was
on
previously
Metacritic.
Metacritic, like that might be, I guess, too big of a sign to ignore.
Also, what happens if Google start aggregating those scores and then people
and
start giving bonuses?
Probably will. That's the thing, because it's very much the direction Google is headed. Like, I think also to get dragged into a conversation about why Metacritic is good or bad, or whether it's easier or not to opt out of Metacritic, is not answering the question. Is it a good thing? It is totally a separate issue. Like, and you know, I do totally see the reasoning why your game made the decision they have. The new system sounds interesting. I still believe that scores serve a really specific purpose. Obviously Metacritic and the influence it's had in the industry is really bad, but it's a separate issue, and it's not the responsibility of any given outlet to change the nature of their output because somebody outside of their...
Yeah, if your problem was just Metacritic and you could opt out of Metacritic, then you could just email them and say, "Don't list my scores on
your
website, please." So,
but the reason that I think scores are good is because even though obviously scores, you know, can be misassigned sometimes or mistakes can be made, majority of the time scores force a critic to make a relatively unambiguous judgment call, usually at the end of a review or especially at the end of a critical process. You can see this in mid-moment, me talking about Son of the Sea earlier, really dwelling on the negatives of a game I otherwise quite enjoy, struggling to reconcile all those competing thoughts and feelings about the game into a single judgment. And obviously this is something you can do with words and should do with words, but scores are sometimes a really handy shortcut to at least to kind of to help you triangulate roughly where the final critical position on a game is.
I think there's something you can do with scores that you just can't do with words, short of writing out the score. Like, because it's easy to list the faults and it's easy to list the strengths, and then it's also easy to do a conclusion that says, but overall it's pretty good. But that's, like, so vague. You can say that about 10 different games that all are actually quite different in terms of how you really feel about them. And it's very, very difficult just in language to pinpoint, to communicate, like, the difference between, no, this is something you really have to play, and something that, well, you might really have to play it depending on
because ultimately, the mileage is always going to vary, right? Mm. Like, ultimately, everything is not going to be for somebody. And I think scores and score brackets and however you choose to do it with the star system or a PC game with a percentage system or anything else, you know, it's really useful for, like, it's really useful from a, like, just a, from a game standpoint point of view. If I get a review in from a writer and they put a big score on the end of a game, they love something, they give it 90, but the review's kind of all over the place and it doesn't settle on the game's strengths, it gives me a kind of way into their mind a bit. I can, as an editor, go, you've given this a game a really good score, but it doesn't really read like that. So you either feel like it's a 90 and you haven't expressed that very well, or you don't think it's like a 90, in which case we need to change the score. But it's a sort of an immediate way to get at potential problems with writing. Whereas if there's no score on the end of that, I don't really know what they're... they've never been forced to kind of like put their judgment on the game in a way that it can be criticised separate from the justification for it. And yeah, it's really useful to be forced to do that. It really makes you think about where you would actually place a game in context with its peers, everything else.
I think all of those points are valid, and I think that even when I don't give a score to a game, like with the work that I do for RPS, I still sort of mentally have that the ticking over of what I would have given it, and so that does actually help formulate thoughts. But then there is also the part of me that really sympathises with people who do have to put scores on games and then get a lot of flack because it doesn't measure up to the person reading its own sensation regarding that game. Because I think often, or increasingly, I've felt that reviews are sort of more of a test card that someone reads to see whether your opinion is right compared to theirs. It's kind of like, it feels like you're often being measured against the other person's experience rather than offering consumer guidance. And so the score can also become just another stick to sort of prod at someone with. And that's not to say that, you know, like, that shouldn't necessarily be the case and you shouldn't hold people accountable for things that they say or opinions that they have offered. But at the same time, it can just be a sort of a negative experience that I don't blame people for not necessarily wanting to have.
But even if it's just not outright abuse like that, it does change the conversation that people are having. People are less likely to discuss the game or particular aspects of the game when there is a score there, and you can see that in the comments. And so if you're trying to foster discussion and see features or articles as a starting point of that discussion or a focus point for that discussion, that scores can be detrimental in that way.
I think you also lose context in some ways, because it's not like you're measuring the review score against that exact person's other review scores. You're sort of looking just arbitrarily at an entire site and saying, oh, so you're saying this game is worse than that one, and so, and you're kind of like,
I've always had that problem.
And it's kind of like, but I'm a different person with different experiences and different reactions to things than this other person. And so you sort of, it can be so helpful and so useful and so good at giving an overview, and it can also be this thing that just strips out context and completely diverts conversations or wrong foots things, or is.
They should have made them different colours. And then, like, okay, yeah, this one did get a 9, we did give an 8 to the other thing, but this is a red 9, and that was a green 9, so you know that's totally different.
I agree with you, but I think that's a solvable problem. I just think websites are really bad at it. Like, I think traditionally magazines are much better at giving you a sense of under what context a score is given. Like, what does a 65 in PC Gamer mean versus another magazine's 65? But when you put stuff onto the internet and it's being found by readers via search and they're just dropping in, and then they've maybe never read another PC Gamer review, it's much harder to convey to them what this actually means. And they sometimes flip out because their expectations have been set by Metacritic or IGN or GameSpot or any one of 1,000 other websites that give scores.
That's the other problem with outliers as well. Like, if someone gives a game 40 and genuinely meant it, but the game has, you know, on the whole got 60s or 70s, then that can be, you know, it's not seen as that person's review, it's seen as that person's failure.
I have a really strong feeling about this, which is that you absolutely cannot be led by the worst parts of your community. And that's true of anything in game journalism, really. And I think the argument against review scores that some people become angry, and when you hold that in the context that less than 0.05% of people who read an article leave a comment, I worry that if that's your motivating factor for removing it, then you are ignoring the successful, you know, communication that's occurred with the majority of people who consume what you produce.
I think I was very careful to say that that's the thing that makes it understandable to me.
Yeah, but it's a reactionary position.
See, like, I think it shouldn't be the only motivating factor, but it's completely fine for it to be one of the motivating factors. And I know, like, I understand the just don't read the comments, or they're only 0.00001% of your audience, and that's absolutely true. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't take into account this thing which is on your website and which fills, by the time a thread is done, 80% of the page. Like, if there is a thing that you're doing which is causing that discussion to be shite, which you can not do in order to make it better.
Honestly, I guess I brought this up today, but like, there's probably two interesting decisions facing how you structure games websites at the moment. One of them's, do you have scores? The other one's, do you have comments? And I'm really in the camp of let's get rid of comments, and not at all in the camp of let's get rid of scores. But like, I wonder to what extent, and obviously numbers are really easy to compare, and every site that maintains a score system has a responsibility to try and work to ensure the internal consistency of that score system, which gets harder as sites expand or whatever. There's a lot of factors that go into maintaining that, and everyone makes mistakes. And I know that on PC Gamer recently, we redoubled our efforts to try and pin everything down again. We redid all of our score brackets, just tried to reset a standard, because it's a machine you're constantly calibrating. You don't do it once and you're finished. But that was within the context that we wanted to keep scores. And obviously, confirmation is done helpful comparison. But I wonder to what extent that kind of, like, people rolling out in the comment threads to respond to something is because what people are actually responding to is a simple declarative statement about a game, which is what, as Tom was saying, critics often struggle to express, or particularly in conclusions, refuse to do. And I wonder if with any other kind of, it doesn't have to be a numbered score at that point, or a number of stars or whatever. It's almost like any simple act of declarative, this is good, this is bad, will ultimately create a similar response in a comments thread as it does in any other context. When if a headline comes out and definitively says something, you'll get all the comments will just be responding to whatever it is the headline said, regardless of whatever followed, right? Like, there's a tendency in the internet just to respond to any expression of certainty with arguing about the certainty of the thing that someone is certain about. And I think the scores are a symptom of that, but the notion that numbers themselves somehow hypnotize people into having a fight about numbers is a symptomatic of a broader thing, not itself a problem with scores. I think it's, get rid of comments, so it's the sort of problem.
My thing is always just I want diversity. So some websites should have scores, but others shouldn't, and some should probably have comment threads and others shouldn't.
Some should have a comment thread where when you go to write a comment, you first have to answer a question about why did Simon give this only an 8 out of 10? What were his key criticisms? And then there's a multiple choice and you have to pick which one he actually said in the text.
That should be good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's probably all the questions we have time for. So... I'm not hosting you.
It's also all the time we've got for the podcast itself.
Should we give the podcast a score?
10 out of 10.
Recommended.
Yeah. Made me cry.
Essential, Tom. Essential.
You heard last week, you basically got there. Yeah.
If you'd like to send us some questions of your own, you can do so by emailing us. Send them to questions@creightoncrowbar.com, or you can tweet us @creightoncrowbar, or you can leave them on our forum, creightoncrowbar.com/forum. There's a special place just for questions. Or if you're really desperate, you can tweet us individually. I am @Gonnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
I'm @C Thurston, C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
I'm @Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
And I'm @PhilippaWar, which is PhilippaWarr.
Holy shit.
It's a ridiculous name.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Graham. I felt like I had to lead it.
You did well.